Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
Hey, bub. Oh.
I knew it was coming.
My gosh. X-Men 2 United is an unbelievable movie. Oh, my gosh.
Wow. Again. Okay. That makes me really happy because this is what I said this last time. This is maybe my favorite X-Men movie, and I didn't know how much that would it would translate for someone that is not familiar with it, that has like none of the nostalgia factor.
How is this not a thing? Legitimately, what did I miss? Like how are X-Men fans not on my feed all day talking about this? Like,
dude,
is it so old? Like, why is this not talked about like Spider-Man 2?
It kind of is within the X-Men community. Like,
I'm just missing it, apparently. I'm just not around X-Men fans. I feel like they should be screaming this at me every day. This movie is really good. And I should have known that.
I mean, I feel like we didn't really talk. We didn't get all the Spider-Man 2 stuff that we now consider to be like what you're saying in terms of people, Spider-Man fans talking about it. I feel like that really came to the forefront when No Way Home came out, when it was the whole conversation ranking the Spider-Man movies and all that. But I feel like once X-Men is in the conversation again, I think it will be...
It'll resurface?
This is certainly viewed within the X-Men film franchise the same way Spider-Man 2 is within the various Spider-Man installments.
The crazy thing about this is there's very little to actually make fun of. Nothing, I shouldn't say nothing, but very little aged poorly. So that's what I can't believe. This movie was released when? 2003? How? I just feel like I should hear more about this in the pantheon of those early day comic book movies. To me, if this was in the MCU and we just had to accept it, like maybe we will in the future with the multiverse, this is a bottom of tier one film. But this is a tier one film.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, I love this. You know, it really is like the Spider-Man to Spider-Man 2 transition in that like there are things that are a little clunky here and there about the first ones, like the action, some of the action sequences in the first X-Men film look very like kind of stiff. And then it's like they just figured out like something got dialed in between the first one and the second one where everything looks pretty incredible.
My other thing is because I don't remember this series at all, I'm going to ask what happened. This must have fallen apart eventually.
Yeah.
Like coming up, I'm saying. Because otherwise I feel like we'd be talking about this still.
Yeah.
There's no way X-Men would have fallen off the face of the earth, I think, if something didn't happen. And so, yeah, maybe it's Dark Phoenix. I haven't seen that. Apocalypse is not good. But I'm just curious to where we go from here because these first two are really good for 2000 and 2003.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, again, it was such a bummer because I remember when the third movie came out, I was so excited, again, in the same way that I was with Spider-Man 3, because I had watched these trilogies progress from like good to great, and I had like every reason to believe both would like exceed the second one for the third entry. And I think the biggest thing, and we'll talk about this there, but the Bryan Singer change as director, I just think is kind of what started things down the wrong path. And then I think it basically took until Bryan Singer was sort of back in the mix with First Class and actually back in the mix with Days of Future Past before it would ever really get back on track.
My mind is just so blown right now, because whenever I would have the occasional friend like Nate Onstott, shout out Nate if you're listening, for example, that would bring up something with X-Men, I've been programmed since this time, since maybe 2006, to just roll my eyes at it. And I go like, oh, X-Men fans. Yeah, like, but now I'm watching it. I'm like, I really like Days of Future Past and First Class. And now I'm going back to these two and they're great. And I'm kind of going, holy crap. Maybe I was the weird one in the wrong.
Yeah. Well, you know, like to your point, it's also kind of, there are several really bad X-Men movies, and that's the hard thing. Like, there are some that are just straight bad in a way that I don't think any MCU movie has ever been. But then there are, like, the majority of them aren't. Because then whenever, like, the Wolverine and Logan, the James Mangold Wolverine films, I think are both pretty great. Logan especially, but I think the Logan's Wolverine unbelievable. Is underrated.
So that's five X-Men movies I've seen that are really good. And I haven't even watched the Deadpool stuff.
Yeah, true. But that it's just The Last Stand and X-Men Origins Wolverine came out back to back, and both were rough. The Last Stand was rough. Like, Origins Wolverine is like really, really, really bad. And so I think at that point,
okay,
it we'll was like, yeah, but yeah, it's going to be fun to move ahead, but it makes me really, really happy that you enjoyed this so much. Cause I like, it held up, like I was a little nervous after ending the last episode. Like, I didn't want to set your expectations too high, but then I started it. And just the opening sequence with Nightcrawler in the White House is so good. And I was just like, from there on, it's like every new element that was introduced in the movie was just like further affirming my choices.
Again, this is for a much later time. The only caveat I'll give to all of this through two films thus far is there hasn't been a single time watching these first two movies that I thought to myself, I need this in the MCU. I still just don't think the worlds are compatible. Not like, okay, a character like Wolverine, totally compatible. You could just bring him in to the MCU and explain how he got his claws and his healing power in a different way, or that he is one of only a couple of mutants like Kamala, and that's it. But the whole plot that works so well in this movie of humans versus mutants, because there's so many mutants and they're taking over, that whole thing is so good here. I just don't know how it exists with the MCU. So they
right.
It's weird, because the whole thing that's core to the story of X-Men that makes it so good is the very thing that they cannot bring over. Yes, they can bring over some stuff, but I just cannot buy an MCU where humans are so mad at mutants for being different when there's already 25 Avengers that are superheroes and celebrities, and they're worshipped. When Thor shows up, he's a god, and people take selfies with him. It's so different that they're going to have to find a way to bring X-Men over without carrying over the whole civil rights type movement thing.
Yeah, which is just hard, because that's at the core of the...
I know.
Yeah.
So I don't know how it works. But we'll get to that a different day. But through two films, I am stoked on what they built over here so far.
Well, and so that's one thing that I want to talk about with X2, like the sort of civil rights core of it. There are a couple of interesting things happening within this movie that I think, even just within the realm of X-Men, are significant. Like, outside of even the film, just kind of the franchise as a whole. It's clearly adapting elements from the God Loves, Man Hates Chris Claremont comic. Like, that's probably the most famous comic arc dealing with, like, this kind of message after the initial introduction. And so, on the one hand, it's nice seeing that having kind of started in the first X-Men movie and then carry over here so effectively. And like I said before, I feel like the stakes were set so appropriately in the first X-Men film to allow like a good step up here, but it still feels like reasonably grounded for how crazy everything is. So I like the way that it's adapted, but I also think it's interesting that like this is when we see a very clear analogy made, not just between mutants as kind of a marginalized race, but there's kind of an interesting like early 2000s like sexuality
100%
comparison going on here.
It's obviously a parallel to any kind of injustice, fight, rights, awareness thing. For example, if you were watching this somehow in the 60s, you easily are translating this to the African American civil rights movement. And now I think in the 2000s, it's definitely a parallel to the gay movement. And the way, like, for example, the way Bobby has to basically talk with his parents. Yeah, exactly. It's almost identical that he's coming out. And like this response, I think, is specifically written this way in that the mother says, "Have you tried not being a mutant?" Which is totally a parallel there, even more than the civil rights movement there. Right. Like that doesn't, like that analogy kind of stops working a little bit, but the gay movement, it still works.
Well, and
so
what's
many
interesting
times in this movie.
Bryan Singer is gay. So he's,
oh, I didn't know
I
that.
Feel like that's a big, and he has a story credit on this. And so I always felt like that was an impactful thing. It like, I feel like part of what makes it work so well is it kind of has, it feels like it has a personal touch to it. And
yeah,
so
I didn't know that, but it totally makes sense now. Like that conversation specifically Bobby is having feels too personal, almost like it's something he's had to have.
Right.
But I think that's why it works so well.
Yeah. And well, and I guess what's crazy to me is that you have that going on. And there are several kind of, obviously there are several plot elements going on, but also multiple kind of sub themes. And I think I'm impressed at how subtly and effectively all of that stuff is working together, because it's like we can talk about how well this is doing that, like channeling the core message of X-Men, but then it's also like it's the decision to use Stryker here as the villain. One, Brian Cox is one of my favorite actors to watch because he's just reliably great.
So he's viewed as great, right? Again, I know nothing about this, but the whole Stryker side of it is a huge win, is it not?
Yeah, oh, for sure. Yeah, and
this would be one of the more notable villains in comic movies, I think.
It's so great, both the way he portrays the character, but also it's such a perfect villain here because it literally amps up what Magneto is kind of warning about at the end of the first film. It makes total sense that that's where we're going. And it continues like the whole like Magneto kind of knows things about Cerebro that we were introduced to in the first movie and builds on that. But then it also is the perfect way of finally getting the Wolverine backstory. It's just no part of that feels shoehorned in.
Yeah. The closest MCU parallel I could come up with is Zemo, in that he is physically outmatched, and there's nothing Stryker can do physically to take down these super-powered individuals, and yet he finds a way to kind of work around that, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that last shot of him being chained up somebody's going to do it if it's not me, feels kind of like that too. Not the way Zemo goes down, but that was kind of the whole premise.
That
eventually it's going to come to a head. I want to bounce around really quickly with just some major things. I am going to start the end of the movie. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm saying this. I legitimately started getting choked up at the very end. I used to make fun of this series. I had no idea that when you consume it fresh like this all the way through, I was legitimately moved. Holy balls, James Marsden. What the heck? His performance when Jean dies actually bothered me today.
Dude.
And I can't believe I'm saying that. I feel like this is such a, like, I totally turned this on thinking I could just disconnect from it, if that makes sense, and kind of just be like, haha, I have to watch X-Men for work. Uh-huh. That was the mindset going into these. And yet through two movies now, I was glued to the screen and legitimately emotional at the way he acts that at the end.
Yeah.
What the heck? Yeah. Why do I care about Cyclops?
Dude, I think that whole scene is pretty incredible. Like the Patrick Stewart, not whenever he's kind of voicing Jean, although even that I feel like is like surprisingly effective, but the moment right after she's gone and it's like the Hugh Jackman, like I love that Cyclops, like it starts with him like shaking Logan and then it ends with him just like, there's like this collapse into his arms.
But Hugh Jackman there too. Like Cyclops screams it and Hugh Jackman's like, okay, she's gone. She's gone. And then after he collapses into his arms, it's like he then realizes, oh no. And he starts getting emotional, but he's delayed in his response. Oh, it's so good.
The Marsden stuff there, you're right. It's especially impressive. And one of my only complaints with this movie, and I think it's only a complaint because of how it impacts the movies coming after this, but I just wish we had more Cyclops in this movie. I like him so much. Like, I like Marsden's take.
Here was another take on that note. I wrote down that what's different between this movie and the first one is that this really feels like a true ensemble movie with no real solo character driving it. The first movie is pretty much Wolverine meets these people. That's the whole vibe.
Right.
That was my take watching it.
Yeah.
This felt like it's not a Wolverine-centric film. Yes, you get his backstory. But I felt like there is a lot more balance to Pyro and Bobby, and Rogue is toned down in a good way, and they kind of tone up Storm in a good way. Mm-hmm. And it just feels more like an Avengers film. It feels like a cast, an ensemble. And I kind of enjoyed that tweak. So maybe Cyclops could have been tuned up a little bit, but I didn't feel that, but I thought it was pretty good.
Well, and again, what we get by him being sort of off the board is, I think, more time with like a character like Nightcrawler.
One
extra person in the mix. So again, I think that in this movie, I'm totally fine with it if we ever got a lot of that character again. And I think that's the only reason why I'm bummed, because I like this version so much. But yeah, the Nightcrawler of it all. I mean, did you remember that opening scene?
Not the assassination. It's so funny, Robbie. As I started watching, what would come back to my mind, like for whatever reason, I remember the dam. Like I remember the external shot of the dam.
Hmm.
I remember the name Stryker and kind of what he was trying to do in creating Wolverine. Like I remember Magneto breaking out of prison, but even that, by the way, hold on. I'll get to Nightcrawler in 1 second. Even that, I used to make fun of, like, oh, I think on this podcast, I've even said, by the time Magneto could control your blood, I was making fun of it. I didn't realize there's an actual plot explanation. I'm the moron. They inject the guy with a bunch of metal.
Right.
I'm an idiot. So I've been making fun of it unfairly. So there are little things that would come back to me. And yes, I remember, like, as I turned it on, I don't remember the assassination attempt, but then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, this is the guy that's kind of spiritual. I remember that. It's wild. Which, by the way, I just think is a fun addition. It's like Daredevil. It's a different kind of thing to have someone serious about their faith. And he, by the way, really contributes to the end of the movie being moving because he's praying while it's happening. I remember Nightcrawler being this like really ambiguous, like gray, sometimes bad, sometimes good character. And that's not at all the case. All it is that he's poisoned of sorts at the beginning. Right. And then he's actually like a good dude after that, even though he looks evil.
That's what I love is that we, like, Nightcrawler would never do the things that he does in that opening scene. So I like that we got the cool factor, like the whole teleportation fight is so well done and it still gets me pumped every time I watch it. But yeah,
Look so good? Why does the movie look so good? How is that possible?
I know. Like that, it's crazy. Like I'm with you. I did not know how well the effects would hold up. Like I knew that
huge step up over the first one.
Yeah.
Like you said.
Yeah, I mean that, and again, just to like start the movie with that sequence where it's like, it reminds me of like the Doc Ock Spider-Man train fight, but in some ways, like, I mean, obviously it's got less to do, I suppose, but I feel like it holds up even better from a effects perspective.
Yeah. The only time I wrote, oh, the CGI is rough is with the fire. Throwing the fire, that is aged poorly.
It looks like when you add like explosions in like MacBook Photoshop video stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. But maybe it's a shout out a little bit to the practical effects of like the dam basement. That was another note I had. The entire dam base was really well envisioned. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was there. Like I felt like I was actually going through tunnels in the dam. That opening spillway is really cool looking. The audio effect they put on his voice in the cave. The whole thing, it felt so tangible to me. So I don't know how much of that was practical. Mm-hmm. The cement walls, maybe they did actually film it in a cement wall thing, but it all just felt really good. Like it's aged well.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious now to see how they actually filmed like scenes with Nightcrawler. Cause I'm wondering if, I mean, you probably could do a lot of that practically. Cause it's like, for the most part, it's just slow motion shots of him kind of flying through the air. And I'm like, if they had like a harness or something, I don't know. I'm curious to like go back and see exactly how much CGI was even used in sequences like that. And I wonder if that's part of it. It's like a Lord of the Rings thing where the best way to avoid aging poorly is just not really use any CGI unless you have to.
So shifting gears slightly, the other part that I did not remember at all, that in my opinion, having seen it now, is a genius call, a smart way to differentiate this movie from the first one. I totally didn't know that they worked together with Eric and Mystique.
Oh, yeah.
That's why it's called United. I remember Charles and Eric being at odds in the first one. Like that was still in my memory. And I remember Eric getting broken out of prison here, but I didn't know that they actually do the whole movie and mission together. Eric is not the villain of this movie for them. And
right.
I think it's genius for so many reasons. It's really cool to see Eric's side of the story where he's not villainized, to see why he believes what he believes, and then to see it come to fruition. The humans are awful. He's correct in what they're doing. Someone like Stryker, to see Charles still stand up to that, and get that final sequence with the president, which I thought was super cool.
Yeah.
A great way to actually envision that.
Which, by the way, I've always felt like, you talked about this with Senator Kelly last episode, I've always felt like the president here does a really great job.
He does. And you know why? It's because they don't make him a dumb, bumbling doofus.
Yeah.
Like, I appreciate that. It, like, you listen to him talk, you're like, oh, I could actually buy this guy, earned his way into a presidency. And I feel like so often these movies, not just these movies, but anything that deals with this, the president always is an idiot. And that's what they're using as like a plot device. And I feel like he does a good job. And he actually listens to the X-Men at the end. I thought that was a really cool performance. Charles freezes time. They all show up. They have that dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And then the power comes back on and all the reporters are like, Mr. President, are you okay? And the way he doesn't say anything, I thought that was a good look. I'm with you.
Yeah. Well, and I love that we saw like it's this kind of symmetry thing again, where like I like the start of the movie with us seeing that Professor X can do that. So it's like this whole movie, I think, does a good job again of kind of introducing things bit by bit. And so it's this powerful thing when it's like lightning and the lights are out in the room and then everyone's freezing. It's just like a visually interesting moment in the film, despite how just kind of dramatic and non superhero-y it is.
Until the very last shot when they say, we'll still be here. And then the lightning's crashing and it cuts to each one and is playing the music. That was a little too superhero-y for me at the very, very end of that shot.
We'll be watching.
Yes, exactly. And then it was like, dun-dun-dun.
And I love that it's Wolverine that says it, because
it feels out of character.
It is out of character. It's just because Wolverine's like the main guy. Yeah. And that's the sort of line that should be from the main guy. But I feel like if that line had been from Xavier, it actually would have been way better.
Yeah, isn't it insane that that's one of my only negatives of the movie? A couple CGI things look weird. That was a total misplayed, 5 seconds? 5 second shot, and that line being uttered by Wolverine, totally inappropriate. Going back to the Eric thing, I think it's so cool that I feel like so often in movies like this where you have an arch nemesis, it'd be easy to say, oh, he's an old friend or we go way back, and you never really get that developed. And that's one huge win in my memory of the entire X-Men saga, are the Charles and Eric moments. Like, they go out of their way to show you that they are friends, they were friends, and they totally disagree on how to handle it. And they're going to do inappropriate things and things they have to stop the other. But there actually is a mutual respect there that goes back years. And I, not only here, I'm a little bit allowing my memory of like Days of Future Past and First Class to spill into that. Because like Days of Future Past does that so well too, where you get the future version of them talking about that. I know the timeline's all messed up. But in general, their friendship being a core of the entire X-Men saga is another huge win for me.
And that's one thing I'm not sure, and for no particular reason, I don't think it's performance related, but like it's always hard for me to see Patrick Stewart in McAvoy's performance or vice versa.
Oh yeah, I forgot you hate McAvoy.
I don't hate McAvoy.
James McAvoy.
It's just I'm not sure that, like, for whatever reason, it doesn't link up in my mind. But
yeah, you hate him.
Love is I can totally see the McKellen performance in Fassbender's, which means I can then kind of see it vice versa. So I think it results in a really strong character kind of across the franchise, to your point.
That's another huge win. One of my notes, Magneto is just so cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he's a villain, but he's a badass. And Fassbender's a badass in the new ones.
the moment when Mystique is in there and you think that they're blasting through the door, but it's actually Eric pulling it like a chunk out of the middle, is just such a because Ian, this is where Ian McKellen having, like what you said last time, that stage actor presence is so key, because he fills a room. Like, there's such a gravitas to every line he delivers that for a character like that, whose power set is so kind of like godlike, it works really, really well. And it's like, it's a strange thing to have someone that is, you know, in his 60s here feel like such a badass, like you're saying, in the way that I would normally think, like that's just an unexpected take compared to, you know, someone like Killmonger being a badass.
Yeah. Another overarching take. There are some really, really dark moments in this film. The Jason side of this is about as dark as it gets. That Stryker is using his son. Technically, if Stryker's plan went through, it would kill Jason, right? Because he's a mutant.
Yeah.
And the fact they include the line that the illusions that Jason put in his wife's brain caused her to drill into her own temple and kill herself.
Yeah. Dude,
there's some dark stuff.
How great is that scene between Brian Cox and Patrick Stewart? Like, it's just the whole explanation, like what you're saying about putting the drill to her temple. But there's just like the little looks that Patrick Stewart has whenever he sees like Yuriko and realizes that she's a mutant, whenever Jason comes in, and like that the way he delivers, like, William, my God, it's your son. It's just like, there are some chills moments there. Like,
dude, it's
dark and sad, but also like, I don't know. It's crazy.
Legit, I only have two more notes and then you can finish up with whatever you want, because I'm just blazing through this. I mean, the main takeaway here is that I'm blown away. I was in the wrong. That's the takeaway. The attack on the school, I thought, was actually really thrilling.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, it
was kind of cool to see Logan also just stabbing all these dudes from, you know, the second floor balcony and stuff.
Dude, that I love, like with Hugh Jackman and the wife beater, just like taking on this entire
And then always army. Doing his visceral grunts afterward.
Yeah. Oh man.
His and it's move like of the knives into the guy's chest and then the grunt. That's like the Wolverine, you know?
Dude, it's well, and that's like that's something that we never got in the first movie. Like we had him fighting with the claws, but it was just, again, never nearly as satisfying as this entire sequence is. In part because Wolverine is like allowed to kill people and we just don't really care for some reason as an audience. So it makes it just like weirdly satisfying and like, I wonder how much that will, if that character does come into the MCU, how much that will be
good point.
A factor whenever we don't often see
Wolverine and Spider-Man do not operate by the same moral compass at times.
Right. Which makes like their comics together really fun sometimes. But yeah, like do we have any? I'm trying to think, is there a Marvel hero existing right now that is generally allowed to kill people? Like, I know that like Captain America does in the first film, because he's at war, and Iron Man arguably does in the first one, just by like whenever he's going and destroying these weapons caches.
Bucky maybe would be allowed to in
his
current state. Hawkeye. I mean, he killed Dracoff and stuff. Or, I mean, like, he was a part of that mission. I guess Natasha. But yeah, not like this though. Not like oh, Wolverine's on a rampage again. Ha ha ha. Bummer. You know, like, right. Right. But that, you know, that would be a fun element to add, honestly.
Yeah.
You say that. Now I think about it. Like, Spider-Man wouldn't, Daredevil doesn't. That's part of their shticks.
Right.
T'Challa never would.
Right.
Cap doesn't, other than in World War II he did, I guess. Cap will, because he's a soldier. It's not like Wolverine, but he will take a life, I think, if he has to.
Yeah, but I think he'll, like, I think he would do everything to not do that. Whereas I don't think Logan is. But that's like, you have to have that with the claws. Like, that's one thing that's always, it makes the Wolverine or the X-Men cartoon that we've been watching through. That's one thing that just makes Wolverine never quite as effective as he could be in that, is because it's a kid show. And so, like, you can show Cyclops hitting people with an energy beam and them just flying through a wall, but you can't show Wolverine stabbing somebody. And so you only get it if it's like a robot, or often he's like cutting through a wall or something. And so I think it's a character that, for the premise to work, you need to have at least like what we have here, in like a PG-13 capacity.
If they bring the Punisher in, he would obviously be Wolverine. That's the same vibe.
Yeah, true.
Okay, my last note. I still, through two films, just don't know how I feel about the love triangle side of this all. Like, I wrote down, like, easy Logan when he's pretty aggressive on Jean, when she says, like, don't, and then he still kisses her and stuff. Right. And then, in general, I think those just aren't my favorite kinds of stories. But you do get a really cool moment, a sweet moment, I should say, at the very end of this movie, the one you were referencing earlier, when Logan says to Scott, she did choose, she chose you.
Yeah.
And Scott, again, smartly from Bryan Singer, doesn't have a line prepared to say back. He just looks at him, acknowledges it, and walks away, which I think is always the right call in those kind of things.
So I agree, and I had almost the exact same thought process. I appreciated where it took us. I think that the problem for me with the love triangle primarily is that it's just underdeveloped, or there hasn't been enough time. Like, it's just hard for me to, like, it's one thing for Logan to have a thing for Jean.
Pause there. Logan sees Jean as a doctor and instantly is turned on and has a thing. That's really all it is. There isn't like a relationship there.
That's like, they've never had a moment. Like, you know, there are, like, I feel like normally, like, if you're following a romance, like your average rom-com or whatever, there's a moment where the two characters are kind of alone and go through something and develop some kind of a bond. And we've never really had a scene like that with Logan and Jean. Like, even, like, we've never had a scene like what Logan and Rogue have in, like, the train.
Right.
On X-Men, but with those characters.
So that's one side of the triangle. The other side of the triangle, Scott and Jean, they really haven't given us that much background there either. Like, if you're going with a typical rom-com thing, you would have some scenes where they're cuddling or kissing and Logan walks in on them, or they're like in the corner talking to themselves and Logan's kind of like, dang, you know, like, there's not really that. They reference that they're together, and there's a line that Jean says where she chooses the good guy. You remember that line?
Right.
But really, until that confrontation, there hasn't been hardly any background.
Yeah.
The only side of the triangle that I think has been effective thus far, and we have gotten some development, is Scott and Logan.
Yeah.
We've gotten the dissension there from the get-go because of it. So that side of it works. But we just haven't seen either really have a long-standing relationship with Jean. Anyways.
Yeah. And I think, like, I buy the Scott and Jean relationship more because I recognize, like they've had all this time together that we haven't seen, at least. I think what's hard with the Logan Jean relationship is like, I think we're supposed to believe that Logan left on Scott's bike at the end of the first movie and is just now coming back. So I don't think that, I don't think he and Jean have spent any time together that we as the viewers haven't already seen. And so that's why it's just hard for me to, like, maybe if that had been handled differently, like if we knew this was like years later and Logan had been living in the mansion consistently, then I don't think that I would have the same issues.
Agreed.
A couple final thoughts for me, if that was your last note.
Please, that was it. I love it. Hit me up.
So, one, I talked about this a little bit last episode, but this is the movie, I think, that really sold me on Mystique as a character. I think that she gets really interesting here. Like, we see that she's got this thing for Logan, but also, like, I really like, instead of her being one of Magneto's three lackeys, I think that the film really benefits from them as a duo. Like, there's an interesting kind of tension chemistry thing there.
Do they have like a relationship, a romantic relationship?
I mean, I think we're supposed to, I don't think we're supposed to think that they do, but I feel like it's meant to be ambiguous. Like, I think that there are a couple of things that feel like they could be entendres. But it's, there's sort of like, there is like a sexual tension there in a way that that feels kinda like weird. It has to be intentional. And especially because
when he says like, oh, you have no idea. I'm like, okay, well, easy, Ian McKellen. Calm down.
And it goes back to like in First Class, we'll see they kind of play with that idea.
Yeah, correct. Correct. Good point.
So. Although I say that because I'm again kind of bummed that they decided to take the Mystique character where they did from here, because I just think she's way more interesting when she's unreadable and you kind of know nothing about her, because I just think that she's written so well. Like, the character design is crazy, but I think really memorable, and I think just the different sequences that we've gotten with her from the very first time she's introduced in the first film, like I think it's just a character that I would be more interested in following, weirdly, than the one that we have now gotten so much time and background with from the original movies. It's kind of like the Han Solo thing, like making the movie Solo, like the movie was totally fine, but it almost detracts because the character of Han Solo is like, he benefits from there being this Mystique, like, no pun intended, like as to his past and like who he is and what he wants. And so when you start filling in all that stuff, it kind of cheapens it in a weird way. And I don't think that there's anything that we ever get in the Jennifer Lawrence films that really makes the character any more interesting than she is to me here, even as, you know, not a real main character of the film.
Yeah, I don't like Jennifer Lawrence, so that's it.
Okay, final things here. I thought it was interesting. Did you catch that Zach Penn has a story credit on this film?
No.
Do you remember Zach Penn?
Yes, I know that name. Hold on. Why do I know that name? He wrote one of the Thor movies, ?
He wrote The Incredible Hulk.
Oh.
But he also wrote the story for The Avengers, which I remember we talked about in our Avengers episode, because we were saying how crazy it was that he went from one to the other. But here again, you know, at this point, I'm like, I think I had, whenever I was reading the MCU book, the Reign of the MCU book, I think that Joanna points out that Zach Penn kind of is this weird behind the scenes, like, goat of Marvel movies with the things he's been involved in, like, you know, across a couple decades. And I did not realize that he was on this film, but that kind of makes sense. Cause like we were saying earlier, I think it does get to be on the Pantheon.
There you go.
And then last thought, just the music here was not the same composer. Michael, again, Common came in, I don't know. It went to John Otland, who obviously carried forward the same themes, but then I think also bases the score around sort of an adapted version of a Mozart piece, which is kind of cool. And I think that that stuff makes the Nightcrawler scenes and things like that work and feel kind of super epic. But I also wanted to point out that Otland came on because he would also come back to score Days of Future Past, which is the next Bryan Singer-directed movie that we get in the franchise. And his score was used in the post-credit scene of The Marvels to kind of ground that within the X-Men universe, and specifically, I think, the kind of original timeline universe to the extent that we're breaking
so that's the hint there. That's the hint there. Okay, interesting. So after watching that then and knowing that, do you even feel more strongly that Photon, Monica Rambeau is in that universe, this X-Men that we're watching?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
You think so? Okay.
I think the big question for me there...
But just in this, 2025 or whatever?
Yeah.
Still? Okay.
So here's what's interesting. Just because we're talking about the Marvels here, and we can talk about this more in Days of Future Past, but I realized as I was kind of looking through the timeline of this whole series, trying to figure out the watch order, that the end of Days of Future Past, whenever Logan comes back and all is made right, that's supposed to be in 2023. So if we're like adhering to the, you know, 2025, like whenever the MCU is right, we kind of caught up, right? Since the blip.
Yeah, this is not my strength. We have listeners who are better at this stuff that actually track this all. I don't know. I thought that we were in 2025, or that Echo, I think, is 2025. I thought I read that.
Okay.
Anyways, ask yeah, else.
I mean, it does. It works out that we had like the pandemic break and the blip sort of corresponding during the same time period. But regardless, if it's any
there's
time
an actual
around
Twitter
then,
account that's dedicated to figuring this out, by the way. I can't remember what it is, but they literally go through and look for any clue of a time period marker. And then,
oh, is yeah, that Dakota? Anyways.
Oh, that sounds right. That sounds right. Is that it? That's maybe the name.
I think
of it.
So. Yeah, I've seen, I used to see those tweets all the time. But anyway, I say all that to say that if we are in 2025 or even 2026 and this is the universe, then I think it stands to reason that it would be picking up kind of right after the events of Days of Future Past, which is kind of cool. But we can talk about that down the line.
Yep.
Main point here is John Otland kind of being the official Bryan Singer sound of X-Men.
Last side note, by the way, we already recorded Days of Future Past on the main feed, I would say 3 years ago, 2 years ago. And what was the content? Oh, you know what? We did a summer series and people just suggested films and we did it. And then you and I were talking about going through X-Men here. And I kind of had said, I think we just repurposed the episode, maybe record a new intro, and then, because we've already done Days of Future Past. But now, with this given the context, I think I want to re-record an episode for Friends from Work Plus listeners, just because now I'm kind of in this world, and I think I'll have a different take on it than the way I kind of eye-rolled some stuff, because that movie's actually really good at times. Anyways, so that was my last note. We'll have to probably redo that one, I think.
I'm really curious to see, not that it doesn't have to be about ranking things, but I'm just genuinely curious how you think Days of Future Past stacks up to this one once we get there. Because I feel like a lot of people treat Days of Future Past as like the best of the series for sure. And I feel like there were times where I thought that, but now I don't know, like having just finished this, I remember how I felt whenever I came on to the Days of Future Past episode, which is probably why you're saying that I hate McAvoy, even though I don't hate McAvoy. But I remember...
Listen, bub, you hate him.
I remember coming on and being like, look, like this movie is good, but it's not... Like it's not nearly as good as a lot of MCU movies. And, you know, we had watched like Into the Spider-Verse and The Dark Knight in the same series. And, you know, it was just, I thought those are in a different league, but I don't know. Like I had such a good experience with this. I'm trying to figure out if I'm going, like I'm just in a better headspace.
We'll get there.
And am I going to, yeah. Will I enjoy Days of Future Past more than I think? And yeah, I wonder how it will stack up to this.
You'll just have to pretend it's somebody else in that role. Like pretend it's Timothée Chalamet and not your boy James McAvoy, and then see if you like it more. I know Candace would. I have one friend, my friend Kirk, that calls me bub. Like he'll call me and go, "What's up, bub?" Or "What can I do for you, bub?" And he doesn't watch these movies, but is that like a thing? Because I love it. It's like what I want to call everybody now. It's kind of mean, but also endearing. And I love it. But if you haven't seen these movies, have you ever heard anyone call someone bub before Wolverine?
No.
Well, let's make bub great again. I'm going to start like calling that. People bub.
If you bring it back, I'll follow.
All right. Dude, this has been a magnificent two-part journey so far. I said this after last week's episode. We say it all the time, but I am now, as a fan, legitimately stoked to watch the third one. I might do it tonight already, just because, again, I don't remember how stuff goes down. And if it does take a step back, I'm genuinely fascinated now to see why. Maybe I'll feel some of the Spider-Man 3 type disappointment that you felt now because I don't know what's happening and I'm a fan. So
yeah,
I'm excited.
Well, and so, okay, this is a good time. I'll leave this up to you, I suppose. My plan, kind of looking at it and trying to make sense of the timeline and then also just structuring it in a way that I think is satisfying. I actually have us watching First Class next.
Oh my goodness.
And then coming back to the third one. But
I don't know if I can do that.
I mean, it's up to you.
Okay, hold on. Really quickly as we close this episode, why? Why do I need to shift headspaces and go back to the 70s or the 80s?
You 60s. You don't have to. And again, this is partially kind of like a sort of a rewatch, but also I've just been trying to figure out the most like I'm curious how this factors in with you being so unfamiliar. But then again, I don't know. I feel like that's kind of the point. I guess my thought was that there are kind of two timelines going here, obviously. After The Last Stand, the next movie chronologically is The Wolverine. And so I think that we either would go kind of all the way through, like from here all the way to The Wolverine, and then go back to First Class and then meet back up in Days of Future Past, which is totally fine and kind of more or less the release order. But I thought it would be more interesting here to break up this trilogy because the first two feel so, again, like stylistically similar. Like even the like the way that they open with the Patrick Stewart narration and the credits, like all of it is like has this kind of Bryan Singer X-Men stamp. The next movie feels totally different than so but does there, the Wolverine.
There's no time travel stuff in First Class, right? So that version of Charles and Magneto is this version that I just watched, right? Just older.
Right.
So right. That could so work. So it's just like a quick little chapter on getting background of their story.
Was kind of my thought because I feel like we do get more development, like you were saying, of their story in the second one. And I thought like the way that was the other big thing is like the way that The Last Stand leaves those characters and their relationship. I feel like it's weird to go from that to First Class. I kind of feel like it's more interesting to go back and look at First Class now that we've kind of had this time we have with them, and then Magneto's out and you don't really know what he's doing and you don't really know what like Charles's next step is. So okay. I kind of, it feels like it's deepening that. But if you're really excited to watch the third one, I don't think that it would be a huge loss to do it that way. I was just hoping to, like in the same way that we talked about, you know, finding a different placement for Captain Marvel and things like that in the original rewatch to kind of address certain like tonal.
But it's not a rewatch for me because I cannot remember. That's the thing. It's a watch.
Yeah. And there are no.
Annika claims she has not seen X3 ever. So let's let Annika decide. I'm going to ask her. She's watching Always With Me. I'll give her the pitch. I'll let her listen to this episode. Uh-huh. And listen to your pitch, and then I'll say, are you okay with now detouring to First Class first? Okay? We'll let her decide.
Okay. Yeah, I like that.
And then we'll make a formal announcement so that people are watching, so that if people are watching with us, they can follow along. How's that?
Okay. Yeah, I love it.
I'll try to influence her into the First Class decision. I think I could wait to see what happens with X3. I understand the reasoning. I could get down with that. And I think First Class is pretty cool, so... Kevin Bacon, baby.
The other thing is I just kind of like I just kind of like the idea of another good X-Men movie from like a momentum like front just to like, it would be such a, like part of what I'm doing is trying to separate some of the bad ones.
Okay.
But anyway, this was fun.
What are your thoughts? Yeah. What are your thoughts? Am I crazy? Do you like it as much as I do now? Did I miss anything? Did Robbie miss anything? Thank you so much for listening. And we know that you are using hard-earned dollars to listen to this episode, and you're supporting Robbie and I. And so we are eternally grateful for that. It's so cool that you would use your hard-earned money on this podcast. And so we appreciate you all. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting. We'll see you next time right back here on Friends from Work.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It pre-prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.